Today we turn to the short story on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Misty Urban writes short stories. We'll inquire into the form with her today on Scribble. The question is always asked of short story writers, why not a novel? But tell us something about yourself, Misty, and particularly how you got involved in writing.
I am a fiction writer from birth, I think. I'm also a medievalist. I have a PhD in medieval literature, and I got an MFA along with that while I was studying out east at Cornell University. I currently teach at Muscatine Community College. I do a little freelance editing on the side, so you can see my whole life kind of revolves around writing. And if you ask my mom, she will tell you I probably started writing around age 5. I had a sister who was a year and a half younger, and apparently I helped her read by writing stories, and I just kept on.
That's the thing that amazes me. It's people who seem to be possessed by writing. And a medievalist, too. Now, you
yes.
really put a hook in me on that. What led you to the medieval era?
I think it was probably all of the Arthurian legends I read as a kid.
Legends?
The Arthurian legends were a big favorite of mine. So I sort of naturally began to study that period, early English literature. And I went to Florida State University after a career as a business consultant, deciding I wanted to pursue writing for graduate school. I thought at the time I was youngish. I had no dependents. I had no debts. I thought this is the time, if I really want to be a writer, to study writing. So I left the corporate world. I went to Florida State University. I signed up to be a creative writer. And as an elective, I sat down in David Johnson's Old English class. And he opened the class by reading Alfred to us. And I was hooked. I fell in love with the language. I fell in love with the literature. And it so happened that David Johnson studied at Cornell. And Cornell, at the time I was in school, was one of the few countries in the program that had a joint degree that you could study an MFA and a PhD at the same time. You could compress all the coursework, be done in 5 years, go off to great things. And so I decided that was the place for me. Fortunately, they let me in, and I had a great time.
So, you know, I can't think of anything more fun than going to college. I had a blast. I loved learning about things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the unusual things was a course in medieval institutions, and that marked me, too. But I mean, you decided to pursue writing. Didn't anybody tell you about writing and making a living?
What they told me was, if you want to make a living as a writer, you have to teach.
Oh.
So I went to get the degree so writing. I could teach.
Well, did it work for you, Tweet?
I never wanted to be a writer. I did like to write, but I never thought of becoming a writer. You know, I've written several books, but all of them have been, by sheer accident, people that have come from the outside and said, could you do a book on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've never submitted anything. I've never gotten a rejection slip.
You haven't lived.
My life
you
is even
suffered.
My life is even more haphazard than yours. You know, I mean,
that's
I listen to you zig and zag, and it really is interesting. You know, there are people who have their entire lives planned out.
Oh, really?
And you know, nature doesn't usually let that happen. But who really do? I mean, I've met students that, you know, I'm right at the point where the very month I should be in my life. But like you, I just zigged and zagged. I started out as an aeronautical engineer, I got a C plus on a theme that I thought was an A theme. It was a D theme. Now that I look back on it, but I said I'll show that guy in college, and I overdid it and became an English teacher.
And here you are.
That's a great way of I think going about. You've had fun doing all this, haven't you?
What courses do you teach, Misty?
Currently at MCC, I teach composition, the analytical writing component, and the research writing component. But I'm always on tap to teach creative writing or literature or anything else, really. Mm-hmm.
Just as long as it's writing, huh?
As long as it's related to writing, yes.
You have a book of short stories. How did that come to be?
That's very interesting. I started writing these stories, the stories in this book, years and years ago when I was working that business job and I was miserable most of the day. And I would come home at night and write, and I realized that I didn't have to actually leave school. I could be a special student. So I audited some creative writing classes at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and one of my teachers there read a couple stories, and he said, you know, you can go back to school for writing. It's called an MFA. And I said, oh, I think I'll do that. So as I said, I went to Florida State University. I got an MA there. I went to Cornell. I was continuing to write all these stories, story after story. When you're in a workshop, the short story is a lot easier to bring and discuss. And when I graduated, I had my thesis, but I still didn't have a book. So I got a tenure-track job. I was really fortunate at the time to get one. And I continued writing short stories. I continued writing the book. And the market for short stories began shrinking and became more and more competitive as time went on. And I thought, well, I believe in this book. I love this book. I'm going to start sending it out to contests, see if anything happens. And it so happens that I sent it to Snake Nation Press for their Serena McDonald Kennedy Award. And I thought I wouldn't have any more luck with that than I did with any other. And they called me 2 days before my birthday and said, we love your book. We want to publish it. Is it still available? And I said, yes. Yes, it is.
That is a fairy tale right there.
That is a fairy tale. I was just reading in Wall Street Journal, A Wrinkle in Time was turned down by 26 publishers.
Oh, really?
I've been rejected by about that many agents.
Yeah.
But I persevere. I have a novel.
Well, getting an agent. Do you have an agent now?
I do not. I'm searching for one for my historical novel. I've moved on. Not moved on. I've continued to write short stories, but I've also begun working on the novel. It's taken me a few years. I've got a novel that's almost close to being finished. I've tried shopping it a few times before it was ready, and nobody really loved it. But I'm going to keep sending it out. I am getting a lot of rejection, but I'm learning from it.
Well, I mean, that's par for the course.
Yeah, writers learn to live with rejection.
You have to.
Harry Potter was turned down, I think, 10 times, 10 publishers.
Mm-hmm. I was turned down by a couple agents very early, and it stopped me for a long time. I thought, well, if I were very good, if I were any good, somebody would take me on right away. And I've learned over the course of time not to let that stop you. That's really not the case. Not everybody is going to love your work.
A lot of our listeners want to know how you even get a hold of an agent.
I have heard of agents being approached in the bathroom and having people hand their manuscripts to them. I hear that's not recommended. You can cold call. You can send in your work and sometimes be found in the slush pile. That's happened to a lot of writers. I think the success rate for a slush pile is about 1%. What I've been advised is you have much better luck finding a personal fit if you make a personal connection, if you go to a conference and meet an agent, if you get involved in them. Twitter has competitions where you can kind of pitch your book and get involved with agents. I've taken a couple of classes with agents. They turned out to like my work, not love it. They gave me great advice. And so I think that's one way you try to establish that personal connection and find somebody. Meet them in person, meet them at a conference, meet them through a competition. Although you can still query, and there are tons of resources for how to do that.
You know, my daughter has helped people relocate and finding jobs and so on. And I said, you know, that must be a discouraging thing. She says, no, there's a fair amount of success. Well, how do you do it? Personal contact is always the way. Mm-hmm. If you're in business and you have moved around in meetings and so on, you've met people from other companies, and you want to move, you think, whom do I know at this business?
Mm-hmm.
And you contact that person, and that is the surest way to have someone pay attention to you. But in writing, I guess you have to have something on a piece of paper that someone can look at and judge.
Yes.
But then you have to be the final judge of that yourself.
That is the thing I've learned about rejection. If I love the work, I'll stay with it. Like mm-hmm. I said, it took me years to get this book together, this book of short stories, and I had a fair amount of rejection. I still have short stories rejected, you know, and on the hunt for an agent, they'll be perfectly kind about it. They'll say, I like the book. I think it's interesting. I think it's well written. It's just not for me. And so I go back to the book and I say, is this for me? Do I love this book? Can I stand behind it? If I can't, I revise it. If it's the side I hate it, I put it aside. I've shelved plenty of novels in my time. If I believe in it, I'll keep with it. And in the end, I have to stand behind the work. I have to be the person who champions it and loves it.
You picked a medieval topic. What era?
This is interesting. My novel I'm working on is actually set in England in 1832.
Oh, not medieval.
It is not a medieval novel.
Okay.
Although I'm sure I'll work back to that period uh-huh. in time. I do love it.
What drew you to that period?
1832?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write a short story about a young woman who didn't fit with her time, was ahead of her time, sort of proto-feminist, was intellectual, and was trying to find a way to pursue her passion. I was originally going to make her an architect. When I started researching female architects in England and Europe, I couldn't find any for the 19th century. Maybe I didn't look hard enough. I certainly hope they're out there. But I started reading about female mathematicians. Sophie Germain, who died in 1831, Germain's theorem. Ada Lovelace, the credited with as being one of the first computer programmers. She is about 17 in 1831, 1832. Mary Somerville in 1831 published a translation of a French work. In English, it's titled The Mechanism of the Heavens. It was a bestseller. So this was interesting to me. Here's a woman who writes a best-selling book in mathematics, although women are not allowed to attend university. Women are not admitted to the Royal Society. Women are not generally published. 1832, I learned, is also the year that the Great Reform Bill passed in England. And this was, at the time, nearly apocalyptic. As it happens, I was thinking about this story at the time of the Affordable Health Care Act in 2008. This is how long I've been working on this novel. And the discussions about reform, how difficult it was for some people, how passionate some people were about it. I saw so many connections to 1832 when there were riots. People thought the world would end if you opened the vote to men who only made about 10 pounds a year. And so I thought this was the perfect setting for this young woman. She's living in this time where reform is possible. I put her in the one county in England that did not go for reform. And I made her an admirer of Mary Somerville. And I thought, let's see what she does. So I have a young female mathematician in 1832 in England, and everything is against her.
Are your short stories also medieval, or are they?
No, my short stories are all contemporary.
Let's hear a part of one. We need to hear some of your writing.
You need to?
Yes.
Do you want to hear about?
I want to hear what you want to tell us.
Okay. I have a couple I marked, but I think I'll share this one, because it's dear to my heart, and I've never actually had an opportunity to read it at any reading. It's called Trying to Find a Corn Dog in Tompkins County. An ivory-billed woodpecker had been sighted in the Big Woods, where part of the Mississippi Delta still stretched its bottomland hardwood into Alabama. A bird thought extinct, invisible for 60 years. It was enough to haunt the dreams. And Daisy still hadn't told Steve about the money. She pressed her hands over her knees, anchoring the skirt of her flower-print maternity dress against the breeze scouring her through the passenger window. Steve had bought the old clunky Escort special for the baby. He called it the family car, though only he ever drove it, and he was driving them now because Daisy had said she wanted a corn dog, and Steve was determined to feed what he was convinced was the appreciable appetite of his son, and had set out in the heat to locate a corn dog somewhere within the reaches of Tompkins County, wherever a corn dog might be found. "It was so much better to be 6 months pregnant," Stacy said. "I worry about this heat and the baby," Steve said. "It's not going to cook him," Stacy said. "You said a corn dog," Steve repeated. "Anything, I don't care." Stacy splayed her hands over her belly, outlining the taut, round thrust of this thing that was part of her body and yet moved on its own. She liked rubbing the underside of this growing belly, navigating the skin she couldn't see. Steve liked his women all smooth and mostly flat, which is why he kept sleeping with 17-year-olds, Stacy supposed. "It's Junior wants a corn dog," she said, putting her finger on her navel. Steve was the one who called the baby Junior, so sure he was of a boy. In Daisy's head, it was just baby, sometimes with a French accent, bébé. "Just go into the store there and get one," Daisy said. "He wants a fair corn dog, I know it, like at the state fair back in November." "He weren't even conceived yet when we went to the fair," Daisy said. "He were," Steve said, "that night, I know it, he remembers." Steve had never moved from Arkansas because his mama and his sisters and his brothers and all their kids were there, and every other Hasper who had been born on and off the record, and Haspers never moved an inch from their family home. But there were no colleges in Tompkins County, and Daisy had just about saved herself enough money to finish her degree. Steve was the stickler for dates. Daisy watched his profile, the way the short brown hair at his temples stuck and turned dark from the sweat underneath his Dodson's feed supply hat. He'd never forgotten their anniversary. He just chose sometimes not to spend it with her, that was all. A tuft of hair stuck out of the back of his cap like a crest, and Daisy thought again of the ivory-billed woodpecker, that rareness revealing itself to the common eye. "I think it gets better after this," she said. "The book says you don't crave so many things in the last trimester." "Yeah, but it said the morning sickness would go away and yours didn't." She turned her head to look out the window, feeling the dust in her eyes that meant tears. His being pregnant made her want to cry all the time, nothing else wrong with her. She'd never cried much, only those first few times she found out about the Fluff Girls, when he swore it wouldn't happen, and it did. It was thinking about the woodpecker made her get all prickly about the eyes. The paper didn't say how many were left out there, if there were a pair or a family. They all just might be seeing the same bird over and over, one bird the last of its kind. This time, though, Steve had forgotten his good intentions all over that little cheerleader, had even taken her away for the weekend and her the principal's daughter up at the high school. They were bound to get found out. It seemed silly to call it a misdemeanor. Daisy herself hadn't waited much past 14. But her daddy, the principal, would want more than a slap on the wrist. Steve might get fixed good, a fine, or maybe even jail. And Daisy would be free. As free as her savings account at the bank. She'd be an ivory-billed Daisy, alone and with her wings outspread. And in 2 months, she'd have a little ivory-billed mouth to feed.
That's very good.
I like it. Yeah.
I like that.
The short story seems to be making a comeback. You know, when I was growing up in the 40s and 50s, there were markets for short stories all over the place, Collier's and Saturday Evening Post.
Magazines everywhere.
Magazines of short stories. And then they seem to have fallen on hard times. But recently, authors who are usually known for novels are starting to come out with short stories.
Yeah.
But there are shorts. They're not the recognizable short stories of O. Henry and the people Ring Lardner that I grew up with.
I can't remember the author's name, but he was a distinguished short story writer, and everyone wondered when he would finally turn out a novel. Powers, I think, was his name.
Oh, yeah.
And what he did, he got a grant to write a short story. He wrote the short story and published it, but kept the rights. Then he wrote another short story on a grant and so on. He granted his way through enough short stories that he could make a novel out of it. He simply stitched them together. He got a grant to do a novel, and there it was.
Brilliant idea.
So, yeah, played the grantsman's game, wrote short stories, but wrote them in such a way that he could make a novel out of them.
Yeah, well, the modern short story bears no relationship to Ring Lardner or any of the old greats at all. They're not really stories anymore. Yours sounds more like story than most of the contemporary short stories. You know, they are what Borges would call fictions.
Mm.
Well,
right? I mean,
yes.
they play with language and stuff, or like flash fiction.
which a lot of people that we've interviewed dabble with too. And I mean, I'd never even heard about it until we started interviewing people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun form.
But I like the style in that story.
Yes, it was very well written all the way through. No wonder they were attracted by it.
Do you have short story writers you admire particularly?
I do. I'm a huge fan of Lori Moore. I think her collection, Like Life, is the collection I read that said, I want to do this. I want to write short stories. I love Amy Hempel. I love Grace Paley. I am trying to think now. No, I mentioned Amy Hempel.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret Atwood. Thank you. The name came right to me. She's another one I hugely admire.
Yeah, but, you know, the whole business of putting some, of creating anything. And sometimes when you write, I imagine that as you were writing that, you figured, okay, this is where it stops. You know, do you have something in mind? Do you have the end in mind when you start the beginning?
That's a good question. I usually do. The impetus for a story will start very often with an image or a character who has a problem, sometimes just a line. With that story, I was standing around in a graduate school, one of those hors d'oeuvres events once, and a friend of mine said, my wife and I spent all weekend trying to find a corn dog in Tompkins County, which is where we happen to live. Ithaca, New York is in Tompkins County. And I loved that line. I thought, yeah, I want to use that in a story. So that story started with the title. It took me a while to figure out what the story was. Very often I do find I can sit down with a blank page and a character, an image, and start there. But I don't see the arc of the story until I know the end. Where do they end up?
What is the name of your collection?
It is called A Lesson in Manners.
And how, if somebody wanted a copy, could they get one?
They could come talk to me because I have a whole bunch in my garage.
Okay.
It's actually available on the publisher's website for those who are online.
Midwest
shoppers.
Writing Center, would they?
The Midwest Writing Center has copies.
Down at the basement of the library.
They sure do. And okay. It's also carried through small press distributors, SPD. So anyone could go to their favorite local independent bookstore and ask for a copy.
Okay.
To be special ordered if it's not
And
on
the
hand.
Title again is?
A Lesson in Manners.
A Lesson in Manners.
A how-to manual on how to deal with love, lies, loss, and loneliness.
Mr. Urban, fascinating story. And thank you very much for visiting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Short stories, that's something that maybe you ought to do, Tweet, not me.
I loved reading short stories. I read short stories all the way through, and I did read Saturday Evening Post and Atlantic, and, you know, they all had great short stories. And that market disappeared, and it's come back in a, you know, I've gotten hooked on the contemporary kind of short story. I say contemporary, although, you know, the Argentine writers Borges and Cortázar were writing the same fabulous fictions that a lot of short story writers are writing today. They bear no relationship to life. They're not intended to. They are explosions of words.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, you know, I had an author living in my attic for about 4 years, and he found Ellery Queen magazine was a good source for him, and he wrote a ton of detective stories,
yeah,
some of which zoomed off into the wildest,
yeah,
ideas I've
That's
ever seen.
That's the market that really has diminished.
Yeah, that's true. Not many people read those magazines anymore.
Well, there aren't many of them.
Here's a book, though, that I want to bring to your attention, Political Tribes by Amy Chua. If you really want to understand why we're having so much trouble, why we continually argue with one another, and there's such bitterness. Amy Chua points out something that, you know, we overlook, that it is built into our instincts, our genes, to form tribes, to form groups. and if you're not in a group, you look around for one to join. But once you're in a group, other groups are enemies. Just look at the business of professional sports. I know Bears fans and Green Bay Packer fans who are just livid, you know, with the other team, the opposing team. And I think it's just a game. Why are we getting so excited? But it is natural for people to form groups. And this country has been different from other countries in that we were founded on an idea that those tribes don't count.
Right.
It's the principles that we obey the law and we live under a constitution. It doesn't make any difference what you are. That's all fallen apart. That's fallen apart, and it's being exacerbated for political gain. It happens on the left as much as the right. The odd thing is that when you form a group to get something good done, to get justice for a minority, it immediately begets enemies. And even if you're either white male Christians, big segment of the country, they feel they're being persecuted. Why? Because they aren't being persecuted. It's just that if you are in a group, a tribe of any kind, you feel a threat from all other tribes. And the world is falling back into tribalism.
And a lot of the world never really left it.
That's right? True. And this country was always thought to be the shining example because we had outgrown that. We had moved past it. But now we're sliding back into it. And as a result, it's chaos. Amy Chua really does a good job of explaining the whole thing, doing some case studies and going through the history of tribalism and how it works. It's the sort of thing that will open your eyes when you read it. And I heartily recommend it. If you take seriously, you know, the travail and the angst, and the way people are so excited and against one another, that's the thing that I find appalling. You should read this because it will help you understand, and understanding may help cure that, but it's no guarantee.
Well, I mean, if you look at the history of the world, there doesn't seem to be a cure, does there? Because it keeps popping up.
Well, you know, they're idealists and mythologizers. I love Teilhard de Chardin because he says the solution is to, as he calls it, ascend around an axis of love, sharpening our differences and appreciating them. Now, that's tough. We sharpen differences as it is, but to appreciate them and to value the differences between people and not to let it throw you back into some kind of primitive tribalism. That seems to be the only way out of this mess, but it's a tough one. But if you read Political Tribes by Amy Chua, you'll have some idea of the enormity of the problem. And you'll also hear the music trickling in the background to let you know that we've used up an enormous amount of time today. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thank you very much for listening. Join us next week as we continue to explore the wonderful world of writing on Scribble.